And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me now is a man that has earned the title of the Natural Navigator. He's a New York Times bestselling author and has led expeditions in five continents and is the only living person to have both flown and sailed solo across the Atlantic. Everyone, it's my pleasure to introduce you now to Tristan Gooley. Thank you so much for joining me today on This Green Earth, Tristan.
Oh, hi, Claire. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. So you have just released a new book that's titled The Hidden Seasons, A Calendar of Nature's Clues, which is bursting with information about the connection between all facets of our natural world, from plants and animals to weather and astronomy even. So before we dive into the book, though, there's so much to talk about regarding who you are and how this book came to be. So what I'd like to do is have you first share with me the impetus that took you on this journey to become what BBC has called the Sherlock Holmes of nature. So what led you here?
Yeah, it was an unusual path. I was a restless kid and I really enjoyed journeys. It would sort of start with, "Mum, is it all right if I go up that hill?" And the brief version was the hills became mountains and lakes became oceans. But what I discovered along the way, quite early on, was that I found journeys that I was shaping twice as interesting, if not more, than when I was following somebody. So it took me a little while to realize that the beautiful art and science of navigation is what gives us the power to shape our own journeys. And so I just threw myself into navigation as a hobby. Everything I could do from my teenage years, particularly in my 20s, I was just shaping journeys. The journeys got bigger and bigger. They got quite bold, quite adventurous. And I started to realize that some of the magic had gone. I heard a very successful author say recently that they were interested in physics as a child, but the poetry left the physics. And I knew exactly what they meant, because the poetry left the navigation. So in my 20s, I started doing much smaller journeys, but just using nature as my guide. And I suddenly realized that everything outdoors is a clue and a sign.
Well, I think that is such a beautiful way to interact with the natural world. It allows you, as you're walking along that path, to really discover maybe something smaller that you might not have seen before, but has such a big role in an ecosystem. But sometimes we just notice those bigger things.
Yes, but I think there is a really exciting opportunity for people who have this feeling, which I've had at times, and I think we all have at times to different degrees and in different situations, where we feel this strange sensation that we know we ought to be engaging and immersing more in the natural world, but we're not feeling the joy coming back always. And so what I found for me personally is that if I walk out into a natural environment and think, okay, I'm going to spend time in this green space, sometimes it feels nice. There might be some sun on your face and you're kind of like, yeah, this feels nice, but nothing exciting is happening. The synapses aren't firing in the brain. What I feel very passionately is one of the fundamental things about being human is that we are capable of building a more interesting picture from our landscape than animals. The animals are, you know, on average, they're bigger, they're stronger, or they're faster, or they have better senses than us. Those are not competitions that we're ever going to win. The thing that we do uniquely brilliantly is we take something quite simple and build a fascinating picture from it. A leaf is boring until you realize the story it's telling you. The angle of a leaf is telling you north or south, which is telling you how to get to where you want to be next. Our ancestors knew this instinctively, but we can relearn it because our genes haven't changed all that much. In fact, hardly at all since people were using these skills all day, every day. So we can all do it. But it's more about fun than necessity, I think.
Well, I think that's great because you're bringing the joy back into understanding what is happening with the world. So you talk about the clockwork system to seasons and how there are certain things that we can rely on each year. If we're looking at spring, what are some of the interesting things about the changeover of that season that can really teach us something?
One of the really fun things is once we start having things to actually look for and we're getting a dopamine reward from solving puzzles, we do see things that other people don't. And it starts with quite sort of broad things. One of the nicest bits of feedback I get is kind of like, I can't believe I've got this far in life and not noticed this. I see it every spring now. So one very simple example, which many listeners will have come across, is that spring moves upwards. So what we tend to find is if somebody's quite deep into a town urban lifestyle, what tends to happen is people see the seasons happening almost overnight. So whether it's kind of spring or fall or any other time, what happens is there's a kind of tipping point where everybody goes, ah, the leaves are out on the trees. Whereas if we know to look from very low to higher, we notice that spring takes place over weeks. So we see the woodland flowers, what are known as the spring ephemerals, appearing before any leaves on the trees, because they've got to get the light before the roof closes over effectively. Then the small trees and low branches have their leaves, then the canopy weeks later. But if we then look for colours, we start to notice that the early leaves are abnormally pale because the plants, including the trees, don't want to invest too many resources early on, because in spring, the animals are loading up, getting ready for their busy reproductive cycle. So they munch a lot of leaves. So the trees have learned over millions of years, okay, we're going to lose lots of leaves early on. Let's not put all the chlorophyll in early. So we're seeing different layers. We're seeing things start low, but we're also starting to notice colours that pass most people by.
And we usually talk in terms of these four seasons of spring, summer, fall, winter. But in the title of your book, you have the hidden seasons. So when you say hidden seasons, what does that mean to you?
What it means really is how things that were hidden suddenly appear when we change our way of engaging to be one of looking for clues and signs. That's at the core of what I do. I've written a few books now, and at the heart of all of them is this simple philosophy that every single thing we see is a clue. It is trying to tell us something. So sometimes things appear obvious. And there was a fantastic American naturalist called E.O. Wilson who wrote once that the obvious is usually profoundly significant. And I think what he meant by that was that if something is obvious, it is a very big part of our day-to-day life. And we can fall into the trap of thinking it's got nothing new to tell us. Let's take something that appears really obvious, like the sun rises in the east. The direction of sunrise changes really rapidly in spring. It's moving north really quickly at its fastest rate. The day is getting longer at its fastest speed in late March, near the spring equinox. The sun is getting higher in the sky near the middle of the day at its fastest rate. So that's what I mean. If we fall into the trap of just going, well, I know the sun rises in the morning. That's what the morning means. There's nothing, that's obvious. There's nothing to be found there. If we pause and say, what is the sun telling me? Perhaps a more specific question like, is the sun due east? That simple question opens up the whole of the way our ancestors saw sunrise. To them, it was both a compass and a calendar. The difference between the direction of sunrise in June, the summer solstice, and late December, the winter solstice, is enormous. You know, for mid-latitudes, it's not far off 90 degrees. It's massive. And yet quite a lot of people don't spot that. But there are things some of us know. But my point really is, if you see anything outdoors, just pause and say, what is the clue? And things that we're hiding start to appear. I mean, we can pick anything you like. It can be animal behavior. It can be clouds. If we just pause and say, what is that cloud telling me? We go, ah, okay, it appears taller than it is wide. Ah, that's a sign of an unstable atmosphere. If a cloud is taller than it is wide in the morning, we'll have showers in the afternoon. Clouds that appear like rocks and towers, the ground will be refreshed with frequent showers. You know, a lot of this wisdom is not that far out of reach. It's not just people 10,000 years ago. You know, our grandparents' grandparents probably knew all of this stuff.
Yeah, and you talk in terms of also celestial seasons, and you have a sky season and a ground season. What is the difference there? Can you explain what those definitions are?
Yeah, I encourage people to think top down. And something I try to do every single day is have a look at the very highest level, by which I mean the celestial. So that's sun, moon, stars and planets. What are they telling us? We've touched on the sun, but with the seasons, we get different constellation patterns. So in spring, Leo the lion is a fantastic one to look for. He rises in the east and then and roams across the southern sky. And in the book, I sort of show you the stars Zosma and Chiron that you can use to line up to make a compass to show you south. But those compasses change with the seasons. There's nothing complex about it. You just have to kind of know what to look for. And then if we come down a level, we look at what the wind and weather and clouds are doing. And then we come down to the ground, and I think of the sky leaving footprints on the ground. So a lot of the patterns we see on the ground are as a direct result of the sun, wind, or rain leaving footprints. A nice simple example is randomness. If we see things and our brain tries to kind of get a little bit lazy and trick us and say, this is just random, that means there's an interesting clue there. Because what's happened is our brain has got too busy in the modern lifestyle. It's saying, oh, I want that fun thing of looking at what's on my smartphone. So I'm going to tell you that this pattern is random. We have to go, no, it's not random. What is the clue? So puddles are not random. Every single puddle is there for a reason. It's telling us a story about rain and sun. We get more puddles on the south side of tracks because that is where the southern sun struggles to reach. There are normally a few little shadows on the south side of a track because the sun is being cut off by bushes or grasses, or in towns it can be buildings or anything else. But that's what I mean, is if you look down a track, a road or a path, and there are a few puddles, the brain at first will want to say, nothing interesting here, you know, pick up the smartphone. But if we're looking for clues and signs, we go, there is something interesting here. What is it? Sometimes it's a compass. Sometimes it's a map. Sometimes it's a story about what animals are doing. But there is always a clue there.
So what do you think it does for a person to adapt this way of thinking and look at the earth in ways of clues and how we're navigating it? How do you think that helps us out in our day-to-day lives?
Well, I think there are huge benefits, but I steer the idea away from it being necessity or pragmatism. There's this kind of idea that for something to have value, it must be necessary in a purely pragmatic way. But sometimes people say to me, is natural navigation necessary? I answer, is music necessary? Are stories necessary? The richest, most interesting parts of our life, the most enjoyable parts, tend not to be necessary in the sense that we do not need them to get through the day. And yet they are a fundamental part of the richest experience. So do we need to know how to read a leaf to find our way? No, we can get through life without that. But do we need to know those skills for the richest, most fascinating journey between points A and B? My answer is yes. So you get all of the practical, pragmatic benefits as a kind of side reward if the sole aim is actually, you know, fun and joy. You know, once you realize that there are over 20 different ways we can navigate by looking at a tree, it becomes almost irresistible. There's a part of our brain that loves to solve puzzles. That is part of what it is to be human. The animals don't do it as well as we do, and our brain rewards us for doing it. If I can just sort of, you know, riff on that a little bit, we all know what it feels like to do something that gives us short-term sort of pleasure, but long-term less satisfying. If we eat a large bar of chocolate, we probably are going to feel quite good for about 5 minutes, but we know 2 hours later, we're really not going to feel very good. Engaging with clues and signs in nature is almost the opposite. We have to say to ourselves, okay, I am actually going to give up 20 minutes of my day here, or less, but 20 minutes is a good benchmark, and say, I'm going to find one clue. So that's kind of making a little effort. And then what happens is, for the following 2 hours, we do feel slightly better because our brain is saying, oh, you finally worked out what I'm for. I'm not all about staring at screens. I'm not all about the indoor lifestyle. We all have a large part of that in our lives. But actually what we evolved to do is to notice, you know, the direction the wind is blowing because birds are perching facing into wind. That's, you know, that's what all our ancestors were picking up on.
That perspective of getting off of our phones and looking at what is around us and enjoying that and bringing us closer, perhaps, to the earth and each other. The planet and how it changes is affecting us, and we're seeing that now in different ways with climate change. The seasons are differing a bit. A couple weeks ago in February, we had this bout of rain. It's very uncommon. And I saw all these worms everywhere. And I thought to myself, in February, so if you're looking at worms as a clue of what's happening with the seasons, it seems like that was a little bit premature. So what are you seeing as far as a changing climate, how that's affecting our seasons or these clues?
Yeah, the first, in the early part of the hidden seasons, what I do is I set out the cogs in the clock, if we're going to use that metaphor, which I do in the book. because it is very helpful to understand how nature is keeping time. So two of the biggest cogs are the length of day slash night. Plants and animals actually gauge the length of night more than day, but it's the same thing really, two sides of the same coin. And as days get longer and nights get shorter, the plants and the animals sense that, and that gives them their broad sense of the time of year. Then the next biggest cog generally is temperature. And another cog is water, and there are a few other smaller ones. And once we understand how they roughly fit together, it makes sense of all sorts of things we see. So one of the simplest but very powerful patterns to notice is that the smaller an organism, animal or plant, the bigger the temperature cog is in its clockwork. By which I mean, big animals and plants, like a horse or a tree. These are big plants and animals. They are much, much more tuned to the length of day and night. Whatever the temperature does is not really going to throw their year out much. But really small plants and animals, particularly things like small flying insects, I saw a cloud of midges, just this kind of cloud of small flying insects today. And today here in the UK was one of the warmest days we've had in weeks here. And that's because small plants and animals react much more dynamically to temperature. So that helps us explain things that otherwise might be a bit mysterious. If let's say there's a small pond and a large lake, and you happen to see both of them fairly regularly, you'll notice that spring tends to come earlier to the small pond because it warms up faster. The day and night lengths are going to be the same for the pond and the lake, but ponds warm up and cool down much, much faster than big lakes do. So just understanding how those pieces fit together, it doesn't change what happens, but it allows us to engage much more because things are more interesting when we understand how and why things happen.
What is the richest, most fascinating time of the year for you?
I do think the times of rapid change, which are they are spring and fall, in astronomical terms, it's always late March and late September, the two equinoxes. I think they're wonderful times because we tend to get the biggest mix and the fastest change. We tend to get things that indicate change as well. So you mentioned beauty earlier in our conversation, and this is, I think, a really good example of how this different perspective and way of looking at the natural world brings rewards. I think, however busy somebody is, if they see a rainbow, I hope they still get a small sense of joy and think that's quite beautiful. Your life's got to have got pretty grim before a rainbow, stops looking beautiful. So, but if we just spend 2 seconds and sort of go, oh, that's beautiful, right, on to the next thing, it's not as rewarding as if we know the stories and the clues a rainbow is telling. And spring is a really good time to look for these things. A rainbow appears opposite the sun. If we see a rainbow, it means the sun is behind us and the rain is in front of us. So if we see it in the morning, the sun is going to be in the east, the rain is going to be in the west. Most of our weather comes from the west. So a rainbow in the morning is telling you you're in sunshine, but it's probably about to start raining. Then the colors of the rainbow are telling you how big the raindrops will be. The more red you see, the bigger the raindrops. Or as I put it in the book, lots of red means a wet head. We can use the shape of a rainbow as part of a circle. And if we imagine the center of that, if it was a whole circle, that's directly opposite the sun. So we can actually work out at the end of the day how long it is till sunset. A rainbow is telling all of these stories. But the really important point is we don't lose any of the beauty. Quite the opposite. Because what happens is if there's no meaning there, someone will go, oh, a rainbow, that's beautiful. Okay, I've got a train to catch. But if somebody knows the clues to look for, they will go, that's quite beautiful. Let me just work out whether it's about to rain. Ah, what sort of rain will it be? Okay, what is the time? Which direction am I looking? A rainbow's a compass as well. And then the beauty comes back with interest. You get this incredible, sometimes a euphoric wave, a sense of joy when you realize that you've got the beauty and the meaning, and actually you're fathoming the meaning and the beauty at a much deeper level than if you just took a mental kind of snapshot and then get on with your day.
Yeah, it seems it unlocks something inside of you. And it feels like if we start to look at the world in this way, it's almost like flexing a muscle. You continue to see the world like this, you'll continue to flex that muscle, you'll continue to open your eyes to new things. Do you go out into the world and are you always finding these clues, does it ever turn off for you? Or is this now how your brain is wired, is when you step outside, you are immediately finding all these clues?
The really nice thing is that it's not a chore. The analogy I would give is a musical instrument. You know, the very first time we play a piano, it's not endless joy. You know, there's normally a teacher sort of saying, you know, these are the scales, or, you know, somebody will be doing it off a YouTube video these days. But you know what I mean? It's, you have to put a tiny bit in at the beginning, but then you get the kind of joy. And then there comes a point where the effort is close to, it's never zero, but it's close to zero. And the joy is closer to 100. So that's what happens for me, is that there is no scene where I'm not getting a little bit of pleasure from the signs there. I will sometimes make a proactive choice to spend perhaps half an hour in one place, focusing quite deeply and looking for, you know, the signs within signs, the richest network I can find. And it becomes quite contemplative, quite meditative. But that is only because I want to go deeper levels and actually unlock a both meaning and joy, and often beauty as well. So it's, yeah, back to the music analogy, we can choose to, you know, just make some fun noise and relax, or we can choose to try and go a bit deeper and find something that's a little bit more profound, and with it more beauty and more joy. I'm doing a little bit of both most days. Some days more of one. If I've got a writing deadline, it'll be, you know, quick fun things, and if I've got a little bit more time, then I might go a bit deeper.
Well, it seems like a wonderful investment in ourselves and in the planet to learn more about it on a daily practice and to see it this way. My last question for you, is there a part of the world in which you find yourself really ignited and it really brings out something wonderful in you as far as navigating the natural world?
Yeah, there's not in a geographical location sense, but in terms of a habitat and environment type, where we get fast change and two different habitats meeting. So really exciting things happen in a nature sense, when you have a woodland meet a field, or a dry area meet a wet area. I mean, all rivers and all coastlines are you know, fit the bill here, because they are, you know, dry meeting wet. And you get these spikes of activity in terms of animals, but quite often plants as well. So it's not about countries or regions for me. There's some good research suggesting that I was in Kenya doing some research with the Maasai tribes people there last week. And there you see it, you know, in their faces and the behavior of the animals when you go from a dry area to a wet area. And there is some research that we do enjoy landscapes that combine these combinations. We want some trees for cover, but we want to be able to see quite far, because that gives us a sense of what's out there, the opportunities and threats. We want to see a bit of water. And so, in answer to your question, that's what I enjoy, and it's what human beings have enjoyed for hundreds of thousands of years, most likely, is a little bit of mixture. You know, we don't want all one thing. So I don't mind what country or region I'm in, but I love it if there's a bit of a smorgasbord of different parts in each habitat.
Well, I appreciate you seeing the world in this way. It's really a gift. So thank you for that.
Thanks so much, Claire. I really, really enjoyed chatting.
We are speaking with Tristan Gooley, who is named the Natural Navigator, the Sherlock Holmes of Nature, and has written several books, a New York Times bestselling author, and a leader of expeditions. Thank you so much for talking to us a little bit more about your latest read, Hidden Seasons. And where can people go to learn more about you and your writings?
Thanks, Claire. Yes, I have a website which will give you a taste of all of these sorts of things, naturalnavigator.com. I'm on the usual sort of social media things. And in terms of the book, it's available through all the usual online platforms. But do support your local bookstores. We miss them when they're gone.
Absolutely. Well, we have a great one here named Dolly. So we'll all hop down to Dolly's. So thank you so much, Tristan, for being a part of our day here on this green earth. And we can't wait to see what you do next.
Oh, thanks very much, Claire.